Hello, and welcome to another edition of Meet the Members. This is episode 4, and today I am joined by Doug Lowry. Doug, welcome.
Well, thank you, Sean. Glad to be here.
So, tell the listeners what you do here at MCTV.
Well, I work for Mass Audubon right up the street at the South Shore Sanctuary at our North River office, and we have been lucky enough to avail ourselves of the studio to create what we hope to become a regular program on MCTV called The Nature of Your Community, The Nature of Our Community.
It's a good title.
Thank you. Yeah. So that's my connection here and why we're a member.
And you've already got one episode out so far, right? And it was on Barrier Beaches?
We do, yes. And we got pretty busy here in this last summer, and so things have been falling by the wayside. But, boy, we've been doing a lot of filming for two or three more episodes that we have on deck.
On what?
On deck. Like a baseball term, on deck.
I thought you meant something in nature called deck, and I was like, I don't know what that is. So tell us about the Mass Audubon Society. Let's get into what you do there and what you do, what the organization does as a whole.
Great. Well, so we are, it's a very old, if you will, nonprofit. Long tradition in Massachusetts. I think our oldest sanctuary, Moose Hill, is over 100 years old. And we are basically a nonprofit that does a number of things. One is preservation of land. We buy a lot of land in Massachusetts. I think we have about 57 sanctuaries, and some of those have various parcels of land. And then we also do a lot of educational outreach for all ages. And that can be anything from workshops to trips to festival celebrations, that kind of thing. And then we have a pretty strong, effective advocacy department as well. So we have folks on Beacon Hill that help bring light to some subjects that are important to the conservation of Massachusetts.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
How did you get into that?
Well, to be honest, I'm only worked there, this is my third, going into my third year, but I had a long history with this particular site over the years, but my first introduction to Mass Audubon was when I was growing up in Canton, right next door in the town of Sharon. It was Moose Hill, which is the longest or the oldest sanctuary, and we'd spend endless hours over there. It would just bike ride away, basically. So friends and I would get over there and tromp through the woods along their trails and fell in love with nature at a young age, and Mass Audubon property was one of the reasons why. So yeah, I was connected for a long time through that, and then recently a job opened up, as I say, 3 years ago, job opened up, and I was doing something else at the time and traveling a lot and doing a lot of outdoor educational kind of work, but I wanted to come back to the community and work more closely with the community that I lived in.
That's pretty awesome. You knew what you wanted to do, and you saw a way to do it. That's awesome.
Right, yeah. It was, yeah, serendipity, too. The position opened up just at the right time for me. So
that's really lucky.
Yeah.
So what do you do there for Mass Audubon Society?
My official title is teacher naturalist. So I create and run a lot of the programming for adults, for our adult audience, but do help out with some of the school programs and nature camp that we just wrapped up about 3 weeks ago. So get to work with all ages.
That's awesome. What goes into, what kind of programs do you do? You, take kids out on, walks and, show them things if you find them in nature? Or do you have specific things that you go through, maybe indoors and then outdoors?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's, for the kids, it could be anything from a public school will contract us to do a beach day. So we take a couple of busloads of kids come to Duxbury Beach more often than not. And they could be anywhere from kindergartners to junior high kids. And we take them out for a few hours of beach exploration, talking about barrier beaches, salt marshes, mud flats, and the importance of preserving those things. Yeah. So that's one way. Other ways, our education director, Amy Quist, often goes into the classrooms, so she does a little stuff indoors, and then hopefully, in a perfect world, she gets to take the kids outside the next visit she goes to. And she runs programs like Project Beak. It's all about birds.
Okay, makes sense.
Go figure.
Yeah.
And it's very effective. I've seen it. I've seen her in action, and I've seen the curriculum that she provides, and it's pretty impressive. Multiple visits, so the kids get a chance to make a connection with her and the program. The final thing they do is they create out of found objects a bird's nest that then they drop from different heights with a chicken egg in it to see if it can withstand the fall. So talking a little bit about structures and
classic school experiments.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the adult programs, we'll do anything. We've got something scheduled. Well, we're going to head up to Stonington, Maine, Saturday, and we're going to stay at a campground and go out kayaking for part of a day. We'll take the mail boat out to Isle of Haute, which is part of Acadia National Park.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. And we'll do some hiking and some natural history interpretation. Might sneak in a little cultural time as well.
And that's available for members of the Mass Audubon Society? Or how do people get sign up for something like that?
Good. So all of our programs are open to the public, members or non-members. You get a break if you're a member.
Mm-hmm.
We have a catalog that's online, and we have a newsletter that just actually the most recent one, the one for the winter, late fall and winter, just came out. And so that's three times a year, and in that would be all the options we have for programming.
That's pretty awesome. And how many of those kinds of trips you do up to Maine, how many of those do you typically do a year?
Well, our office in particular probably does half a dozen of those kind of things.
Oh, wow.
Our director, Sue McCollum,
mm-hmm.
Does international trips. She's a tremendous bird watcher, and a lot of our international trips have that theme, bird watching theme, not exclusively, but for the most part, it's why people are attracted to them. And so she, I believe, this year is going to Ecuador.
Wow.
But much more locally, she's doing a Block Island trip coming up, which is filled. And so we do a camping trip down in Wellfleet. We're doing this one up to Maine. We have a all-day trip down to the Outer Cape coming up in November.
Oh, nice.
We'll hit all of the seashore, the National Seashore.
That's incredible. Wow. What's been your kind of favorite thing to do with Mass Audubon Society?
Good question. it's not a cop-out answer, I hope, but it's more the people that come to our programs.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the funnest parts of it. As you can imagine, it's pretty self-selective.
Mm.
These folks that are interested in Mass Audubon are invested in nature,
mm-hmm.
Interested in nature. They tend to be fun and some eccentric in a great way. I like to think we all are.
Yeah, of course.
The success of a program or a trip is definitely directly connected to the quality of the participants, and we're lucky to have such good ones.
And what's nice probably is that everybody who's there wants to be there. No one, I'm sure, feels forced to go on these awesome trips and learn about nature.
Yeah. And like summer camp, the Nature Day camp, the kids that come are just fantastic. They're excited about being there. They actively participate. They go home at the end of the day pretty tired. We try to sneak in. The main focus is to have fun, but we try to sneak in a little bit of science and natural history that hopefully they absorb. I know they absorb it as the
like sponges, those kids.
Yeah.
Do you get a lot of Boy Scouts and stuff like that?
We do some programs with Boy Scouts. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's been a while for Girl Scouts, but the Girl Scouts as well. We do some orienteering, map and compass, that kind of thing. In the past, we've done programs on outdoor cooking with that segment as well.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. I bet they're really into that too. I imagine all the boys and Girl Scouts are all already into nature and being outside and all that already. So doing
absolutely.
That probably helps.
Yeah, it's a obvious kindred connection.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you are a self-proclaimed bird nerd. I believe
correct.
You said.
proud to wear that label.
I don't know how to articulate it, I guess. How did you get into nature and enjoying all that? You said you go to Moose Hill and all that. How did you find your love of nature and all things outdoors?
Well, if I could bring it down to one particular event that really stands out in my memory, my parents were really good about advocating for us to be outside, as many of that era did. Your parents would let their kids out, and as long as they got back in time for dinner, it seemed like everything was fine.
Yeah.
So they gave us tremendous liberty and freedom to get out and enjoy the woods, the neighborhood woods. And so I found friends that were interested in the outdoors as well. But one event in particular really stands out, and that was my dad bought a canoe, and we did some trips in this canoe. And one time, he and I were on the Charles River, and we were going around these bends. And the Charles River is a beautiful river, even to this day. There's a lot of buildup on it, but it's still, back then there was less of it, and it was very beautiful, bucolic. And we heard great blue heron squawk, which if you know their squawk, it's pretty primeval. And they kind of, if you look at them a quick glance, they kind of look like a pterodactyl silhouette. But anyway, so this we came around this bend, and there was this great blue heron standing on this rock, and we might have surprised it, but it froze and just stood still, and we paddled right by it, maybe 10 feet away.
Wow.
And it kind of just kept looking at us. And that point in time really had an effect for me.
That's pretty incredible. I had a somewhat similar experience just this past month. I was, I think it was for the 4th of July, I was kayaking, paddleboarding with some friends on a lake in Plymouth, I think, or Kingston. Mm-hmm. And a swan just takes off and just flies 10 feet away from us, just right across the lake, just doesn't pay us any mind. And I'm just like, wow, that is one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. Just right there, just flew right by and just going about its business.
Yeah, swans are amazing. They need a lot of water.
A lot of space.
Need a lot of space in order to take off the land. Yeah, so it's quite...
Yeah, I was a little frightened. I was like, I hope that thing's not flying at me to attack, because I know they're pretty territorial.
They can get aggressive.
But it was a cool experience. Mm-hmm. You said a blue heron. what exactly is a blue heron? Because I've seen them before. They seem to be somewhat rare, but maybe that's just my uninformed opinion.
Well, they're around, and I think for such a large bird, and it's a pretty colorful bird, but it has the ability to look nondescript. You could drive right by one on your way to work on the edge of a pond or in the marsh with unless you're looking specifically out for evidence of bird life, you might just drive right by it. They're a pretty large bird. They're about 27 inches tall or so, easily a 6-foot wingspan.
Wow.
But what's amazing is one of the heaviest great blue herons would be around 5 pounds, which when you think about a 6-foot wingspan,
it's only 5 pounds.
This doesn't seem like a lot of weight. And you see them flying in some pretty strong winds. But yeah, they're obviously in the heron family. They're one of the largest herons that we have around here. There's a few worldwide that are a little bigger, Goliath heron. But they congregate this time of year. Some of the older great blue herons will try to stay through the winter. I'm not sure how much capacity they have for reason, but I think a few of them decide that, you know, they're getting old and they make a decision to stay rather than fly because the migration can be quite traumatic.
Yeah.
But there's been occasions when I've driven across the Duxbury Bridge and looked out into the marsh and seen 70 great blue herons.
Really?
This time of year, kind of gathering around and feeding before they migrate. But yeah, you're lucky. You'll see a great blue heron every month of the year here if you're looking for it.
I didn't know that.
We always get them on our Christmas count, which is a pretty amazing event as well.
Wow. And so 70 of them just eating, getting ready for the fueling up for the drive south, if you will, fly south.
yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So many birds rely on, because they're flying such long distances, they really have to load up on calories and fat. Mm-hmm. So some birds will gain 50, 60% of their body mass and weight before they migrate. The smaller birds do that kind of thing. And then they will expend all of that until they land and have to refuel.
You're telling me about one bird that flies from like this tip of like Argentina all the way up to like the North Pole almost in like a matter of days, right?
Yeah. There's the Arctic tern, which is definitely the champion of long-distance migration. But I think you're referring to the red knot, which is one of my favorite birds. It's a shore bird that really is it's an amazing animal in that it has the need to adapt to several environments. One down in Argentina at the very end of South America, Tierra del Fuego, it is eating basically things off of the intertidal zone, beaches, isopods, little micro and macro organisms. And it needs to eat a lot before it takes off. And not only does it need the fat and calories, but it needs the water on board that you get from eating food, because it won't land until it gets to the Amazon River Basin.
Wow.
Where it then has to refuel on an entirely different food source, much, much different than what they're used to down in South America, or the tip of South America. And then they make another move up to the eastern seaboard, many of them landing in Delaware Bay.
Wow.
To time, and it has to be timed with the horseshoe crab mating and egg laying, because then they
eat the eggs?
They eat the eggs.
Ah.
And then get ready for their final journey to the Arctic Circle, where they raise their kids and then fly all the way back down again.
Why do they do that?
we don't know. There's theories. not a lot of predation in the Arctic Circle. That's some, for sure. But yeah, there's some theories out there, for sure.
Wow. Makes three stops on its way from one half of the globe to the other.
Just. Yeah. And a lot of birds make those huge distances in short amounts of time. They fly it, generally speaking, even the warblers, the small, tiny little birds that are impressive in their migrations. They fly mostly at night, so they minimize the amount of heat and water loss.
Mm-hmm.
And they also use, or it is theorized, theory that they use the stars to navigate.
That's pretty incredible.
And we look at, you know,
it's a little thing.
Until you get an appreciation for birds, it's easy to overlook just how amazing they are. And that goes, you know, well beyond birds, too, to all the other creatures that we share this earth with.
Wow. They can just do things that we just couldn't even fathom of doing.
Like, no. We took hundreds of years to learn how to fly.
Yeah.
And we're not very good at it.
No. Still doesn't feel natural when I'm in a plane.
No.
I had flown in July, and I sit in the plane and we're taking off, and logically I know this is totally fine, like, but my body's like, this doesn't feel right. Like, I'm not supposed to do this.
Yeah, I agree with you there. It's best not to think about all the moving parts.
Yeah. So what have been some of your favorite animals or environments or ecosystems around here that you've studied? Like, because we have the marsh. We have just such a diverse type of diversity of types of ecosystems here. It's
right.
Probably wonderful for you.
It is. Yeah, and the first thing you start to recognize, and this is, you know, basic outdoor education. I mean, every kid that's gone through any sort of formal outdoor education, I'm sure, has heard this phrase, this web of life. I mean, everything is connected to something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what's fascinating to me, is that, you know, we are so lucky to live here on the South Shore and in Marshfield in particular, and we have so many things, so many different environments to explore and to study. And so, yeah, we get the seashore and the salt marsh and the beaches and the woods, the ponds, the rivers, the lakes. I mean, the North and South River, just incredible places. But yeah, it doesn't take long to realize that, boy, one thing is connected to another, and if one thing were to be eliminated, then the whole thing would collapse. I mean, everything is keystone species, keystone environments. One can't exist without the other.
I bet that's part of, like, the big issue right now. You see a lot of species going extinct or endangered and things like that. We don't really seem to, as a species, understand the impact of this thing going away and taking everything with it.
Right. And, you know, I think through Mass Audubon and other like-minded organizations, people are starting to get the word. I mean, it's hard to look at what's happening in South Florida right now.
Mm-hmm.
Without making a connection to habitat loss and pollution and the overuse of pesticides and agricultural chemicals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're learning, though. I think
as
more people become aware of it, I think those issues will hopefully go away, or hopefully they won't just cover it up as something else. In somewhat related, how do you feel about kids today? I feel like a lot of kids are indoors a lot as opposed to outdoors. You just pop in front of the iPad and they can just sit there for hours. And I don't know. I'm not sure how I feel about that, being someone that kind of grew up in that phase. Like, the first half of my childhood, no cell phones, no internet, like all that stuff. And then the second half, after I got to like high school, was all cell phones, internet, you know, what's going on Twitter. Like,
right. Yeah, I'll be the first to admit I'm a Luddite when it comes to electronic advancement, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. I found myself kicking and dragging, screaming into the digital age. The first time I really recognized that I needed to move out of the Stone Age was at the Marshfield Library. Mm-hmm. When they had eliminated the Dewey Decimal System and everything was on computers. And I was trying to look up a book, and I had trouble even getting on to the screen.
Oh, really?
And there was this little kid, maybe 7 or 8 years old, next to me, and she could tell I was frustrated. And she looked up and she goes, "You need help?" Yeah, I guess I do. And I need to move on. So, but anyway, it's a great question, and it's a subject that a lot of people have been writing about lately and researching, and absolutely, there's all the evidence points to that it's important for kids to get outside and be in. It doesn't have to be wilderness, everything's on a scale. They just need to get out and run through the woods.
Interact with the world, swim.
Exactly. And that's not to say that there isn't a comfortable interface with technology. I mean, it's used a lot in research. We wouldn't be making the advancements that we are without it. But as far as kids are concerned, I don't think any of us, if you ask any age or any generation, if you ask them, would you like to spend more time outside? The answer would be yes, sure. Yeah. And what are some of your favorite memories? And those memories are more likely going to be things that they did outside than, my favorite memory is I got to level 5 on, death and destruction or whatever.
I'm sure that's a video game. It's definitely a real video game. No. Yeah, that's something I've been kind of being more aware of myself is, I'm getting into like the workforce and, being in front of a computer all the time. I try to make special attention of going outside and running around and just kind of enjoying the fresh air every now and then, because you kind of because we only have so much nice time outside during the year here in New England. Right. So I know I'm going to spend the whole winter indoors, freezing, wishing I was outside. So as soon as the nice weather comes, I just run out the door. But
sounds like a great formula.
Yeah. So let's talk about how you kind of got into doing the show here at MCTV. Like, what prompted that? How did that come about? Because I remember one day you, Mike, and Ned just came in and just started showing us all this awesome footage you had and was trying to compile it all. And I was like, this is awesome. Like, where did you guys come from?
We're still trying to figure that out. But, I'm just so impressed with when you can use, I guess it ties into what we were just talking about. If you need to get your message to an audience, then you got to meet the audience where they are. Mm. And so we're limited in the number of people we can bring into programs and offer programs. But we were kicking around some ideas at the office about how can we better outreach and images of like David Attenborough's Planet Earth came to our mind. And We knew that we wouldn't ever get to that point, but realized how really effective film is to get your message across. And then when we discovered that MCTV would let you take out cameras and would teach you with some very, very fine instructors, I might add, on how to film and how to edit and put something together, we jumped at the chance. And we're glad we did. We still have, it's typical. We know, now that we know a little bit, we know how much we don't know. And so it's exciting to know that there'll be always something to learn. And if you're patient, one thing we've learned is if you're patient, you can always make something look a little better, get the message a little more focused. So, yeah, I've come to learn to appreciate the whole filming and editing and producing part of television shows. My brother does it for a living as an animator, and I never really appreciated the work he has done in his life until we started making this little show.
You know? Yeah,
it's just incredible how much work goes into it.
And as an animator, you get to do all the you basically have to be the actor for the character. Like, get to do every little tiny little movement, every subtlety. Like,
yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool. He's an animator?
Like, yeah.
For like cartoons or?
It's all stop motion.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
He works for Leica Studios out in Portland, Oregon. It's been connected to some pretty fun projects with Wes Anderson and
wow.
Tim Burton. And
that's really cool.
Yeah.
Huh. But to go back to that, how was the learning curve? As you just moments ago, you're talking about how being at the library, a little kid, you know, is using the computer to show you how to look up books and everything. How was that transition been, like, to learning how to do all this?
It's been really fun. It's a steep learning curve, sure, but you know, you get the right people and the right resources, and you know, it's fun to keep learning, and it. At 59, unless you push yourself to learn, it's easy just to get comfortable with what you think you know, and you know, it's kind of lazy. You get, I think, well, I won't speak for anybody else, but there's a temptation sometimes to plateau, mm-hmm. to think, oh yeah, I'm, you know, this is great. I'm at the top of my game, and you know,
this is all I need to do.
Not a whole lot more that I need to know or learn, and that's just, you know, that's nuts.
Yeah,
yeah, you got to push yourself and learn new things, because it's exciting. It's life affirming to be able to keep learning.
And you guys, you go out with these cameras, and you get some beautiful shots of animals and birds and things like that, like. Just from, like, the look of it. Like, you had one the other day where you must have been, like, 100 yards away from this bird, and it's just, you could see the little raindrops just bouncing off its face as it looks, like, straight up into the sky, and, like, how the little beads of rain just, like, kind of stick to its body before it just, like, takes off and, like, shakes it all off. Like, it's really cool what you guys get.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's fun. I mean, you can see it. It takes patience and being, you know, so much of it's being in the right place at the right time.
Mm.
But, you know, you, like, I got a long way to go. We have a long way to go. But I have, you know, friends that are still photographers that they know the game. They, I mean, they're willing to go out on any kind of day, whether it's rainy, snowy, hot, whatever. If they know they're looking for a particular shot of an animal, then they know they've got a number of things they have to pay attention to. One, they have to take a photo of that animal with the least amount of impact as possible to that animal's life. Then they've got to find the lighting just to be right. They've got to get close enough so they can frame something that's going to come out good. And they know they're going to have to be out there maybe 5-6 hours, you know, to get the shot they're hoping for. And they might not get that shot. You know, they might have to go back again. So, or they might not get it at all. And so that's the one of the things that I'm glad we learned right away was that, you know, not every shot's going to be, you know, that shot of the of the hummingbird with the rain on its dripping on its head.
But you got a lot of them.
I guess when you got it, you got to go for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been fun. You know, I've also learned it's been very helpful to. Because there's only a limited amount of space to be able to hold on to some of this footage, it's been a great lesson on letting go.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't regretted at any point deleting something we've taken because, you know, you can always do better. So it's nice. It's kind of cathartic to just hit something that you thought before was going to be something worthwhile and just delete.
Well, what's the next episode you're going to be doing? I can't remember if you said it at the beginning.
Well, we have a couple of things in the making. We're working with Pam and Steve French, who own Wild Birds Unlimited,
okay,
in Hanover, and we're going to do a show on attracting birds to your backyard. It's kind of that's the general theme, but it's going to go off in different directions mm-hmm. from there, like landscaping for birds. Learning what you're looking at, you know, trying to get an idea of what birds are likely to come to your yard, along those lines. We're also now, embarrassingly enough, missed our second opportunity to finish up a Signs of Spring, which will come out next spring. But I'm glad we haven't tried to force it because the footage we have is I'm really happy with. And so to wrap it up into a half, well, as you well know, trying to get a half hour show that's quality means that you can always cut something out and bring in something that might be more appropriate. Mm. And so that's where we're at with that project. And then Amy, our education director, which I talked about before, is she is our narrator and kind of on-screen personality. Mm-hmm. And you know, we need to work around her schedule as well. She's a busy person. so there's that. And then what I'd really like to do is get Norm Smith, who is the director of Trailside Museum. He's the one that relocates the snowy owls every year.
Oh, wow.
Out of Logan Airport, and puts them up in the North Shore or often much more locally, Duxbury Beach. And so that I know we could get some great footage there. Have, you know, he has basically have snowy owls in his hand.
Wow.
You know, so we could get some fantastic footage there. And that tells a pretty important story, too, the whole snowy owl story of how why they end up at Logan Airport.
Why do they?
Well, it's often in years where there's a very successful breeding season.
Okay.
Where there's a number of owls or owlets that survive. The mortality rate's pretty high, but some years and they're still trying to figure this out. You know, it's certainly climate and certainly food source connected to that. But the years where there's a bigger brood, that means more competition. So in the winter, and owls, basically snowy owls, hunt during the day or night because there's, depending on the time of year, there's always either always light or there's very little light. Mm. And so they have a pretty specific diet in the Arctic. They go for mostly lemmings. But once there's too many, they get pushed out. The juveniles usually are the ones that get pushed further south. And they come down this way and follow the Atlantic seaboard to some degree, but they also go through the Midwest. And they end up at Logan Airport because it looks so much, believe it or not, like Arctic tundra.
Really?
Yeah. You know, except for the pavement and all the planes.
But it's just like wide open space for them.
Wide open space. And, you know, grasslands around the outside of the perimeter of the macadam. And it's got a lot of mice and voles and rats, I imagine. So there's plenty of food for them to eat there.
Oh. I would have figured the gigantic airplanes flying by would have scared them away, but wow.
Yeah, you would, but no, there they are. And it's not exclusive to Logan Airport. I mean, they will sometimes just come down this way and land at Duxbury Beach just out of coincidence.
Huh.
But yeah, the last couple of years there's been some strange sightings. I believe there was one found in Bermuda, and there's actually been one hanging around all summer long this year.
Is that a strange thing for that to happen? Do they usually go north?
It is, yeah. But anyway, so he obviously they're a hazard to flight.
Yeah.
And so he has permission. He's like the only one that I know of that can get out onto the property of Logan Airport. And he baits traps and catches these owls and brings them down and releases them here. He releases a few up on the North Shore, too, depending on the bookends of the season, where they, do pretty well. Plenty to eat at Duxbury Beach. Lots of mice and voles. And snowy owls will actually eat other things as well. I've heard stories. Well, Norm tells a story of a snowy owl taking out a great blue heron.
Really?
Yeah. but they'll attack ducks. We had a friend who saw that last year. In fact, was snowy owl took out a black duck.
Is it like a territorial thing, or is it like looking
for
food
type?
It's just eating it. Wow. That must be pretty cool to see something like that happen. Mm. Wow.
So that would be a fun episode.
Yeah.
and I think that would have a broad appeal. We realize that there are certain animals that people gravitate towards.
Mm-hmm.
Even people that might not be that, in general, interested in nature. There's a few like these animals that just, like the panda bear.
Yeah.
That's why the World Wildlife has such success with their logo. The snowy owl is one of those.
One of those like iconic
animals. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And so is the barn owl. Owls have such a kind of long history in mythology and all across the world. So there's that connection.
I don't know if you'd seen it. Desmond says, and I saw it too, on the bridle path right behind CVS in the marsh area, there's apparently a family of eagles.
Bald eagles, around. Yeah, bald eagles are making a comeback in this area. There's been, we're careful about how we share the information just so that we minimize the impact of, it's great. No, it's important for people to realize it's happening, and it's important for people to see them, for sure. And you can, at this point, see bald eagles anywhere in Marshfield.
Wow.
There was one last winter as I drove by the Veterans Park. It was sitting on top of the wheelhouse. The water wheel. It was sitting on top of that.
Wow.
Just hanging out, looking for fish.
Wow.
In the pond there.
That makes sense. That's like where the fish ladder is.
Yeah,
so.
So they're around, and they're on the South River, and that's a good spot to see them from, is the old railroad bridge, both upstream and downstream. I've seen them there. The North River had a nesting pair. In fact, I believe Cape Cod was the last. Bald eagles disappeared from the Massachusetts landscape at one point.
Really.
Completely, and they were gone for decades. And the last successful nest during that period of time was on Cape Cod. And so now Cape Cod is about the only place left in Massachusetts where they haven't reestablished themselves.
Hmm.
And recently there was evidence that there was a pair attempting to build a nest on Cape Cod this past year. So that would be a success story for sure, is if we could have bald eagles nesting across Massachusetts.
Is there anything people should be aware of if they see one of the, like, it? I mean, I don't think you should, obviously you shouldn't approach it, but.
Yeah, it's not likely you're going to encounter a bald eagle that closely.
Okay.
Unless it's on its terms. They have been known. It was one of the most amazing wildlife experiences I ever had. I was fishing for Dolly Varden trout in British Columbia, and I had gilled this trout. The hook hit the gill, so I got the hook out, and I was holding the fish down in the water, hoping to see if the water would go through its gills and if the fish was going to make it or not. And I let go of it, and Bald Eagle came down and took it, and I could feel the wind from its wings.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, there was like this huge airplane in front of me. But anyway, so that's, I mean, that's where you're going to likely encounter. If you're fishing, they're interested in what you're, Bald Eagles would much rather have somebody else catch their food. They're more
swooping.
Yeah, they're more scavengers than they are hunters.
Okay.
But, yeah, so no, you shouldn't have to worry too much about negative interactions with bald eagles. They'll keep their distance. There's no mistaking them when they're flying over. They're just huge.
Hmm. Got that big white head.
Yeah. David Ludlow, our property manager, who's probably one of the best bird watchers that I know, describes it as, if you see a piece of plywood flying over you, it's probably a bald eagle.
That's pretty funny. Anything people might not know about you that you think they might find interesting?
Oh, that's kind of
putting you on the spot.
Well, I guess kind of going back to what I said before is I've had a long history in outdoor education. The last 20 years of my career, before I came to Mass Audubon, I worked for the National Outdoor Leadership School as one of their field instructors, senior field instructors. So I was a sea kayak instructor, and we would teach leadership and communication, decision-making, risk management on 30-day expeditions into the field, into the wilds. And I got a chance to see some pretty amazing things in that part of my career. We were living in nature for sure, and so we got to see nature in all its glory. But the commonality between that job and this job is that, again, it's amazing as nature is, and the amazing things you're going to learn about nature. It is the most fun to be able to share those experiences with people,
mm-hmm.
People that are with you, and you learn something every day if you surround yourself with other people. You see things through their eyes, and yeah, again, you don't know what you don't know until you know a little. Yeah, it's. I look forward to more adventures with Mass Audubon, for sure, and being exposed to folks that are attracted to the organization.
Well, we look forward to the content that you're going to put out there and see all the beautiful shots, all the nature, everything like that. If someone wants to take one of these hikes or one of these guided trail walks, where do they go?
So they can go to our website, massaudubon.org/South Shore. We'll get you closer to home. But if you want to just see what catalog choices there are across Massachusetts, which we encourage you to do, then just go into massaudubon.org. We'll get you there as well.
Awesome. Well, Doug, thank you for being on today. If people want to see the first episode of the show, it is on barrier beaches. It is on our website at marshfieldtv.org. Go to watch. It's in recent episodes. I think it might also be on Vimeo.
It is.
Yeah. Okay, it's on Vimeo as well. Give it a watch. It's great. Good quality stuff. Half hour. Doug, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, John. We look forward to getting some more shows out. It's so funny when we first started talking about this, and my director Sue McCollum, who has the patience of a saint, and is very encouraging, knows enough to let people get to the realization on their own. She's like, well, what's your vision? How many of these things do you think you're going to be able to do? And I'm like, oh, you know, maybe once a month. I'd love to be able to do once a month. And she just kind of looked at me.
Like, okay, Doug.
Didn't say anything. But, yeah, it'll be a lot of fun. And we won't do once a month, but I'd love to get at least four or five out a year. That would be my goal.
That would be incredible.
Yeah.
That's a good goal to strive for. Thanks again.
You're welcome, Sean. Thank you.
And that's all we got for today. This is Meet the Members. I'm Sean Leary. Thanks for listening.